Welcome back. And now I'm delighted to say, as promised in the first half of this program, we welcome to the studio tonight, Green Gartside.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here, and I'm holding in my hand a moment ago, a best of Squitty Politti, which is come into my possession. She's a superb collection of things. what would we play if we were going to play a Squitty Politti theme?
What would I choose?
Yes.
Well, purely at random, really, I would choose a song called The Word Girl, sometimes called The Word Girl. It's kind of small, but quite nicely formed. And that seems as good a choice as any, really.
A lovely piece of music. When did you write it? Can you remember?
I wrote it in about 85.
And what inspired it?
Not long ago.
No, exactly. Yeah.
What inspired it? Let me think. I've got to remember how it goes now. Well, it's a kind of reggae thing, and I'd got into, having started in punk or post-punk, whichever it was, and all we used to listen to was reggae, and then we got into kind of lover's rock. I was a huge fan of Gregory Isaacs. I used to follow him round. As far as I can recall how it goes, it was some sort of version of something influenced a bit by Lover's Rock.
The World Girls, Squitty Politti, and I'm delighted to say that Green Gartside is our guest here this evening. So, Green, that was an amazing sort of time, I think, that your records were quite unique. There's a bit of elements of the punk music, if you will. I don't know what it is, but there is something of that time.
Yeah.
But lots of other things were coming into it as well, weren't they?
Yes, if you say so.
Yes.
No, I'm prepared to gratefully accept that analysis.
And great people on one of the old Patty, because Miles Davis came and played.
Miles.
How did that come about?
Miles did a cover version of a song that I did called Perfect Way on the first album. When I got tired of doing kind of indie post-punk stuff, which I did get tired of, and I thought it'd be more fun and interesting to go to America, and I wanted to work with a producer called Arif Mardin, who had done, worked with Aretha and Shaka and everybody else. So I did an album with him, and there was a tune on that called Perfect Way, which Miles covered, much to my surprise. So it seemed like a good idea to get in touch with him and see if he would like to come and play on a new song that I'd just written in Islington. And I don't know why that's important, the Islington bit, but...
Well, no, it is, and I think it does, because I like the idea of Miles Davis perhaps being telephoned from Islington,
but
the dream that he might visit Islington.
He didn't. He used to ring me in Islington. We did record it in New York, and I was very surprised. It was just me and David Gampson, the keyboard player. We were at the studio very anxiously waiting for him to arrive, thinking he might, roll in posse deep or something, but he came completely on his own. I've got a video, actually. I did half surreptitiously video him in the studio with us, and we were in there for quite a long time, and he was a delightful man. I subsequently went to visit him at his apartment in Central Park, and he would ring me quite often at strange hours when I was back in the UK from New York. And then he died, sadly.
We should play the thing with Miles Davis on it, actually. Maybe later on in the show, I think we should play that. We've got something else we're going to play. Something else you've picked. When you first listened to music, where were you growing up? Where were you listening to
it? I grew up in South Wales in a new town called Cwmbran. The Beatles was my respite from, what wasn't an unalloyed joy of a childhood. And I got very much, as millions did, I guess, and... whatever the power of pop music is, they unleashed it for me, and I followed them wherever they led, and I wanted to know why this record didn't sound like the last one and what their lyrics meant and, who was the Maharishi. And they led me to all sorts of places, musical and open my mind to the world of ideas.
So what Beatles one would you choose?
I Feel Fine.
Good. I Feel Fine, chosen by Green Gartside, who is our guest this evening, and we've been talking about Squitty Politti and all sorts of other things. Mm. Great to have you here, Green. It's marvellous.
Thank you.
So, in a moment, I think we should play Patty, because we were talking about Miles Davis playing on it and you meeting him. There you had been listening to the Beatles in a small town in South Wales. Mm. How do you jump from that to getting into sort of playing music yourself and kind of, making that jump?
Well, I wouldn't have ever made that jump had it not been to leap ahead a bit. 1976, The Clash Damned, Sex Pistols, Heartbreakers came to Leeds, where I was an art student. Been an avid consumer of music of all sorts up until that point, but it was really seeing The Clash and falling in love with them, and also the kind of DIY lessons that I learned from the Desperate Bicycles, who, you know, it was easy, it was cheap, go and do it, make your own record, that opened the door to the possibility of creating music, not just consuming it. Mm. So that was, you know, we blew the last of the art school grant on buying a drum kit and a bass and a guitar, and left the art behind and started to make our version of music.
And your version of music was very, it's very distinctive sounding. It sounds like you. Is it? How did you do it? Was it multi-tracking onto like you know?
The later stuff was. We started off as a kind of post-punk band, you know, all sort of one take, played very badly, almost kind of trying to make a virtue of our inexpert playing. There was that kind of messy aesthetic of the time. And then I tired of that and thought it would be more interesting, fun, challenging and radical even to try and do some stuff that was like proper pop, for want of a better word. And the most important pop at the time was black American pop music, with sort of hip-hop at one end of the spectrum that was very important, and the beautifully syncopated delights of, you know, the Quincy Jones stuff or the Arif Mardin stuff, the Leon Silvers. And I wanted to know what it felt like to make some of that stuff. So that's when the studio became the place to be.
Your palette.
Yes.
Well, let's play. Should we play the... We were talking earlier about the, how you got Miles Davis came and played on this. Mm. So let's play Patty.
Okay.
Oh, Patty. Brackets, Don't Feel Sorry for Lover Boy. We're by Scritti Politti. Green is our guest here. Dave, you said you bought that record.
I did. I think the album's called Provision.
It was, yeah.
And I bought it on cassette tape, and I still have it to this day.
Does it still work on cassette tape?
Yeah.
That's very nice, isn't it?
A lovely album.
Yeah, very good album indeed. Yeah. And I'm delighted to say Green is here with us. So, there we were talking then, how about you went and saw The Clash, then you started recording and stuff. But how do you then jump from seeing The Clash in to actually getting into making records and like kind of being out there and us hearing you on the radio and everything?
Punk said that even though you were inexpert at making music, you both could and should have a go. So I rose to the challenge. The difference between that and the kind of stuff that that I was doing a few years later was that it was difficult, it was expensive, but go and do it. You know, once you'd been allowed to start making music, it didn't seem to me any good reason why you shouldn't try and make music that was, you know, a bit more difficult to make. Mm. Or it was difficult to make for, you know, someone coming from my musical background, completely musically untrained, and to try and make something relatively sophisticated. That was a challenge, which I looked forward to.
Yes, which you embraced. But then did you go and do gigs? What did you do? Did you go and record companies knocking on doors? What did you...
I'd kind of already, when I was on tour in the punk days, I can remember being on tour with a Gang of Four and having... I thought I had I ended up in hospital, and it was a very bad panic attack. And but the hospital, they detected some small heart arrhythmia, possibly it was, and said, oh, you know, maybe... It scared me off playing live anyway. I did get very panicky. And we got to New York in those days. I can remember while making Cupid and Psyche, the album there, the guys from MTV coming down and say, well, you know, you don't have to play live anymore. You can just make videos. And that sounded really appealing to me. We did actually get together to try and play live after that. I can remember getting into a studio in Manhattan, a rehearsal room, and not being able to remotely approximate the sound of the record. Although we had come up with it, we couldn't really play it. Do you know what I mean? There was a lot of recording, you know, endless takes, tons of drop-ins, people along to help, you know, machines involved and stuff, that in those days it was very difficult to... So we didn't play live and instead had to go and do promo for 9 months, sitting on morning television shows and talking nonsense.
Nice. Yeah. But did nobody say, when you had your panic attack and didn't want to go on stage, yeah, did nobody say to you, the most important thing you've got to do is get back onto the stage? Nobody said that?
No, no one said that for 20 years, really.
Oh.
No, literally, I think it was 20 years before I played live again, at Jeff Travis from Rough Trade's suggestion/insistence.
Right. Excellent. I think you should play something live for us now. Would you do that?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Not wanting to put you on the spot. You know, yes. As you said.
Eyes glaze over.
Ambulance. Panic attack. Medic standing by.
We can play. What would you like? Let's play something. What would you like to play?
If we had to play something completely uncharacteristic of me, it would be a Free song, because I adored Free. They're my favourite band after the Beatles. Went to see them live in the Paget Rooms, Penarth. First gig, and
nice.
It was a fantastic evening. I would have been 15.
Yeah.
And this is a song particularly ill-suited to me and my oeuvre, so it'd be fun to play.
I think it'd be great fun to do, and I love Free as well. So let's enjoy. Here we are with Green Guardside. Let's give the Steeler a go. That is great. I think you sing that great. Have you ever thought about doing a record of covers of other people's music?
No.
Well, so I'm just putting the idea into your mind.
Yeah. And I'm rejecting it out of hand.
Yeah. And what do you think, looking back at it all, what do you think, what advice would you have given to the younger you, do you think?
Go and get some help for panic attacks.
Yeah.
Don't prevaricate.
So now the next piece of music you've chosen for us is Captain Beefheart.
Yeah.
When did you first hear Captain Beefheart?
At school, it was, you know, the two ways to hear music were, you know, the Beatles had given you the taste for finding things that challenged your listening a bit, I thought. And the two ways were either listening to Peel's show. I used to record his show every week. And by the end of the week, when you'd listen to it innumerable times, it was the more challenging music that I found, you know, the more appealing.
Yeah.
And the other way was at school, you know, swapping albums with people. And someone had a copy of Trout Mask Replica. Had a sort of a trout with a top hat on, didn't it? More or less.
Yes.
Honestly.
Yeah.
Something like that. Anyway, so I took it home and it scared the bejesus out of me because it's a peculiarly challenging record. I don't know. I grew to love it and to love Beefheart. And after making Trout Mask Replica and Lick My Decals Off, Baby, which are two fantastic records, he made a few records that were, you know, not so likely to offend the delicate sensibilities of your listeners, for instance.
Yes, exactly.
And this would be one such track. Shall I tell you what it's called?
I think so.
It's called Nowadays a Woman's Gotta Hit a Man.
women have tears in their eyes. You can ask them about me, I swear.
Captain Beefheart. Is that right? He did created that record after locking people in all the musicians in the shed for a month in the desert. Is that it? Sort of the rough
not
idea?
Not this particular record, but Trout Mask Replica. Yeah, he did. Mm. He did kind of imprison his band, starve them, and dictate their every move to them for 9 months, after which they were able to make a magnificent piece of music.
What's next for you? What will you be doing? You know, you've got this great... The Scritti Politi is a great review of all the... Because you've had some amazing different music you've created, and it is on this CD, which we shall leave on in a moment. But what would you like to do next, do you think?
I'd like to finish an album that I've been making for Rough Trade for the last 3 years, which should have been finished 2 years ago. But I've just got too many... I've started too many songs. I've got like 150, maybe 180 songs started. I mean, some of them are like four-bar what's-its. Some of them are nearly finished songs. And what I'd really like to do is finish the thing this year.
So, thank you very much for joining us. We're going to play one more thing from this Scritti Politi. There are some great things on here. What should we play last?
This is something that called A Day Late and A Dollar Short that I recorded... in Long Beach in California about 18 months ago.
So this is quite recent.
Not heard by many people.
Well, we're looking forward to it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us this evening, Green Guardside. And we very much enjoyed hearing Scritti Politi.